breaking. I spoke into the phone, telling her I was in love with Jim, but I couldn't confess my feelings to him. Suddenly, Jim walked in the door. I turned and saw him, and my heart felt like it might burst out of my chest. I wanted so much to tell him how I felt, but before I could, he kissed me. It was perfect. The director yelled, "Cut." The producers came on stage from their hiding places and had that confident, satisfied look about them. Not to sound too braggy, but we all knew we'd done it. We'd just filmed one of the best first kisses ever on television. We did two more takes for safety, and that was that. It felt amazing. If only they all went this smoothly. My next big on-screen kiss was for the movie Blades of Glory, a comedic kissing scene with John Heder. Unlike The Office, there was no month-long planning session. On the day of the shoot, we had a rehearsal and discussed the scene with the co-directors. They thought it would be funny if we really go for it during the kiss, since our characters had been so reserved for most of the film. John and I thought we understood what they meant by really go for it. Later that day, we shot the scene. John and I, remembering the note to really go for it, did an over-the-top, passionate stage kiss, opening and closing our mouths and smashing them together. We did a few takes like this, but kept getting the same note. "That was really good, guys, but when the kiss comes, we need you to really go for it. Like, really, really go for it." We really wanted to get it right. So on each additional take, John and I kissed harder and longer, our lips working overtime. But the directors still weren't happy. Finally, after the fourth take, one of the directors came up to us and said, "Guys, there's no easy way to say this. We need you to use your tongues. We're in a close-up, and we can tell you're faking it. That's what we mean when we say go for it. Tongues, not length." John and I started laughing so hard. We'd totally misunderstood the note. The next take, we went for it, tongues and all. It was actually the first time either of us had used our tongue in a kissing scene. And it worked. Speaking of tongue, I used plenty of it in my love scenes with John C. Reilly on Walk Hard. Hey, I just realized I've kissed a lot of Johns. Not only did we have a scene where I licked his face, we also filmed what is probably the most intimate love scene I've had to shoot so far. It was a highly choreographed, over-the-top comedic sex scene with lots of slapping, choking, grunting, face-licking, and very little clothing. It was part love scene, part stunt. At one point, I had to knee John in the groin while he pretended to choke me. We practiced the blocking over and over again. Everyone knew what to expect and when to expect it. It was almost like a dance. Even though it was a satirical comedy, when it came time to shoot the scene, John C. Reilly and I were nearly naked in bed together. I was wearing a nude thong and a strapless nude band over my breasts. John was totally naked, except for a flesh-colored pouch that he wore over his penis. The purpose of these outfits was so that no nudity was accidentally caught on camera. But in real life, they certainly didn't leave much to the imagination. Our director, Jake Kasdan, was very respectful. He requested a closed set. That meant no visitors, no photos, all video monitors showing the scene were to be shut off except for his, and only crew members that were vital to the shooting of the scene were allowed on the set. Just so you know, this is something you can request should you ever be asked to film a love scene. Tell the director you want a closed set, and they will give it to you. John and I were brought to set wearing robes, which we kept on until the very last second. As soon as Jake yelled cut, the robes were rushed back to us so that we didn't have to stand around nearly naked while getting notes and resetting for the next take. By the time the scene was over, we were exhausted and dripping in sweat. John C. Reilly and I bonded quickly that day. We had to trust one another, and I feel privileged to have worked with him. At the end of the movie, he gave me his penis pouch as a wrap gift. I'm very lucky that I've never had a situation in which I felt compromised while shooting a love scene. I've always felt very safe and respected. An actress friend of mine told me that a very well-known actor once put his hand up her skirt during a love scene. Mind you, this was not a planned move. She called over the director and said loudly, I don't remember discussing him putting his hand up my skirt. Did I miss something in the rehearsal? The director looked at the actor sternly and said, No, we didn't discuss that. Don't do it again. Good director. When it comes to love scenes and stunts, ultimately, you are in charge of your safety and comfort. If there is something you don't understand, ask. If there is something that makes you uncomfortable, speak up. How to be a good guest. It's not easy to come onto a working set only to spend 1 or 2 days doing a small role. I've been there. It's kind of like being the only stranger at Thanksgiving. The regular actors will most likely be polite, but not overly friendly. You won't get a lot of reassurance from the director. She will be more focused on the regular cast than you. Your wardrobe will likely be rushed and ill-fitting. You won't have a friend to keep you company. It can be kind of a lonely experience. Despite these disadvantages, your job is to show up, lay low, do your work, and leave. Imagine you've got a clogged toilet, and you call a plumber to fix the problem. There is nothing more annoying than a plumber who arrives late, chats your ear off, slows you down, and tries to sell you a new bathtub. Don't be the actor version of that annoying plumber. Show up on time and prepared. Keep to yourself, and don't ask to take photos with the cast or invite the cast, director, and producer to your upcoming improv show. Don't suggest additional dialogue or ways your character could return in later episodes. Don't worry about networking or standing out. Don't ask people about retrieving a copy of your work for your reel. Your agent can call the production later and ask on your behalf. Just fix the toilet. Everyone will love you if you just show up and fix the toilet. When I was on That 70s Show, I played Stacy Wanamaker, a snooty bridal store clerk who gives Jackie, played by Mila Kunis, a hard time. I was in 2 scenes with Mila Kunis and Wilmer Valderrama. It was the 7th season and also Topher Grace's last year on the show. Now, I always get nervous when I start a new job. I can't help but worry about being good, and I also wonder how I'll fit in socially on set. I feel kind of like a little kid starting in a new school. So being the guest on a hit show amplified everything. The cast and crew were all friends. They had been doing the show for 7 years together. I felt like a fifth wheel. No one talked to me during rehearsals. No one talked to me during breaks. No one asked me to have lunch. In fact, no one asked me a single question about myself. The only person who said more than hello and goodbye to me was Kurtwood Smith, who played the dad on the show. We chatted briefly at the snack table one day. I'm pretty sure no one learned my name. It felt so odd to me at the time, but I came to learn that this is very normal behavior. It doesn't make any of them jerks. In fact, I can't say enough good things about this group of people. They were talented, gracious, and very well-liked. At the end of every tape night, the entire cast would go into the audience and sign autographs. Imagine my surprise when Topher Grace stopped me as I was walking back to my dressing room after tape night. We hadn't been in any scenes together, so we were never formally introduced. He said, Hi, I'm Topher. You're Jenna. You played Stacy? And I said, Yeah, that's me. He said, Man, you were fantastic. You have this great deadpan comic timing. I loved what you did in that scene. Really cool. How's it going for you? I said, Well, this was a big deal for me just now, but it's been hard, you know. I'm struggling to get any job I can. He said, Just keep doing what you're doing. People didn't totally get my thing at first either, but you are really funny. Trust it. Great job. I blushed, and we shook hands and went our separate ways. But wow, what a cool moment. Years later, when I was on The Office, we ran into one another at an awards party. He said, I remember you. You were on That 70s Show and played the snooty shop owner. I knew you were going to blow up one day. Congrats on everything. Again, wow. Since then, Topher and I have become friends. We've starred in a movie together, The Giant Mechanical Man, and are even producing an animated television show together, Adult Content. An actor going out of his way to be supportive is a rare thing. Like I said, most of the time you will leave the set wondering if anyone knew you had been there. Here's what I learned from Topher that day. Taking the time to say one brief, nice thing to a guest actor goes a long way. I've never forgotten this gesture, and I do my best to pay it forward. If you're nice to an aspiring actor, they will never forget you. I remember every single actor who took a moment to be generous with me when I was just starting out. Here they are. Molly Shannon, Topher Grace, John C. Reilly, Michael Douglas, Linda Cardellini, Robert Forster, the late Peter Boyle, and Matthew Lillard. They have my undying gratitude and loyalty. My greatest example of a generous acting partner is Chris Messina, who worked with me in the movie The Giant Mechanical Man. Chris has worked with Woody Allen, Sam Mendes, Amy Adams, Jennifer Aniston, and many more. He is a great partner. He makes it his goal to give his partner whatever they need for their performance to be great. One night, while working on The Giant Mechanical Man, Chris and I had an outdoor scene on a train platform. We were shooting in Detroit, in the wintertime, and it was freezing. Chris played a street performer and was supposed to remain perfectly still, like a statue, while I delivered a long monologue. What's more, he was painted silver and standing on stilts. Meanwhile, my character was bundled up in a parka and wool cap. First, we did the wide shot. Then we moved in for my close-up. I told Chris he could stand down and get warm. He didn't have any lines in the scene, and I didn't want him to freeze if he wasn't on camera. I was perfectly happy to look at a mark on a tall ladder to help me pretend I was talking to him. Chris would hear none of this. He said he would absolutely stand there, no matter how long it took, because he believed it made a difference. Through multiple takes, he stood there, off camera, freezing in 10-degree weather. And he was right. It made a huge difference. Unfortunately, not everyone is Chris Messina. I've worked with actors who didn't know their lines, actors who only cared about their side of a close-up, and an actor who showed up to work with a debilitating hangover. I once attended a table read for a project during which the lead actor was sending emails on his smartphone from under the table. Another time I was doing a scene with an actor who forgot one of his lines and then loudly blamed me, saying, "I couldn't remember what I was supposed to say because of how she was looking at me." He was clearly embarrassed that he messed up, but instead of taking responsibility, he lashed out. I have a friend who did a play with an actor who, for the first week of rehearsals, refused to say any of his lines. He just barked at her like a dog. True story. I once worked with an actress who couldn't remember her lines. When it was time for my close-up, she was messing up her dialogue so badly it completely tanked my performance. During a break, the director suggested we do a take without her and have one of the production assistants read her lines off camera. I agreed, and he told the actress we were breaking for lunch. Then, when she left, he had me do two more takes without her. I was lucky the director advocated for me. You too might find yourself in a situation where you have to find creative ways to protect your performance, despite an unhelpful partner. This can be difficult when you're just starting out because you may not have the status to fight for what you need. Most actors I've worked with are kind, professional, and prepared. But every once in a while, you get an unprofessional jerk. It doesn't happen too often, but if you find yourself in one of those situations, just remind yourself that the good news about acting jobs is that most of them don't last too long. If it's just a few days on a project or a few months, you can get through it. That said, if you are in a situation in which you feel you are being abused or harassed, tell someone. You shouldn't have to work in a situation like that, even for one day. Shifting gears, let's talk a little bit about the actor's code of silence. Creative environments require people to expose themselves in very vulnerable ways. It's an intimate business we work in, without much privacy. But actors should be able to go to work and not have to worry about exposing themselves to the public. I've worked with a lot of big stars and heard about their private lives. Sometimes this was intentional. Sometimes it was unintentional. But no matter what, I never repeated any of it. When I did That 70s Show, Wilma Valderrama was in the midst of a tabloid-heavy relationship with Lindsay Lohan. Ashton Kutcher was with Demi Moore. While we were on set, I observed and overheard a lot of details about those relationships. I never told a soul, not even my closest friends. I inherently felt that part of the job of a guest actor is to help maintain an environment for the artists to feel safe being themselves. Once, I had a job with a very high-profile actress who kept leaving the makeup trailer to vomit. It happened 3 times. I knew she must be pregnant, and a few months later, it was announced that I was right. I never told anyone. As for myself, one day, I had to sign my divorce papers on the set of The Office. A clerk brought them to work, and I had to sign them in front of the cast and crew during a break in shooting. Another time, I broke down crying on set when I got a message that my grandmother had died. I wept on the assistant director's shoulder. Everyone kept it to themselves. So, if you're feeling gossipy, pretend you're a priest or a therapist and keep set banter confidential. Hopefully, one day you'll be the celebrity actor and need to count on other people's discretion. Don't spread gossip. And don't sell stories. Protect the artists. You're on the inside now, so be a member of the family. Eddie Murphy and Will Ferrell. I was at a party once, and I heard a story about Eddie Murphy, told by a guy who'd played an extra in one of his movies. He told us that at the beginning of the shoot, the extras were rounded up and sternly told, "Under no circumstances are you to speak to Mr. Murphy. In fact, don't look Mr. Murphy in the eye when he's on set." The actor telling the story implied that Eddie Murphy was a big jerk for having a rule like that. Who does he think he is? We're all people. If I was famous, I would never do that. We're an artistic community. Now, first of all, who knows if this guy was telling the truth? Who knows if Eddie Murphy has this rule or if it was just some PA trying to look important in front of the extras by giving them a bunch of rules? But for argument's sake, let's pretend it's true, and Eddie Murphy demands that people not speak to him or look him in the eye on set. Hold that thought while I tell you another story. I've worked with Will Ferrell a few times, most notably on the movie Blades of Glory. This was a huge budget movie, and Will was the lead. He had a big job with lots of dialogue, elaborate costumes, and ice skating stunts. Here is what I observed. From the moment Will walked out of his trailer until the moment the director called action, someone was speaking to him. "Hey, Will, how's it going? Can I get you anything? Do you need a coffee, Will? Water, Will? Anything, Will? How was your weekend, Will? Cowbell, Will! Hey, Will, my son is a huge fan, and tomorrow is his birthday. Do you mind taping a little message for him? Hey, Will, when are you going to host SNL again? What team are you rooting for this weekend, Will?" It was crazy. Every step the man took, someone was talking to him. He couldn't even take a breath. Now, Will is pretty much the nicest man in the world. He seemed to speak to everyone. But I couldn't help but wonder, how is he able to concentrate? Somehow, he can. The attention seems to work for him, or at least it doesn't rattle him. Could you imagine if, on your way to an audition, every single person you encountered from your car to the casting office was speaking to you, or staring at you, or taking your photo? Could you give a good performance? Not me. It's unnerving and distracting. I'm a nervous and shy person. I feel vulnerable when I have to perform. I need space to focus. Will seems like a naturally social person. He must somehow thrive on the energy of connecting with people. That's not me. Luckily, I'm not faced with this problem. People don't talk to me all day or ask for photos. But if that did start happening to me, I'd probably need to create some boundaries to do my job well. Which brings us back to Eddie Murphy. If his process requires him to be left alone, I'm not one to judge. The pressure and attention is so great for a lead actor. Millions of dollars are being gambled on his or her ability to deliver a great performance. Eddie has done a number of movies where he portrays multiple characters, which means he's got to remember improvisations he did as the dad character that need responses when he's dressed like the mom. For Pete's sake, if the man needs space, give him space. And don't judge him for it. As long as the actor's need is communicated with kindness, a request like this should be met with respect. I believe it is our job to nurture and protect one another. You wouldn't judge an Olympic athlete who doesn't want to chat you up moments before hitting the uneven bars. Resist the temptation to become cynical, judgmental, and negative about your fellow artists. Most importantly, don't be judgmental about what you need to thrive as an artist either. The more you work, the more you will learn a process that helps you give the best performance possible, which includes everything from your preparation time to your time on set. What routines can you adopt to center yourself? I did a play in New York, and I had to share a dressing room with the other actors. I found myself having a hard time focusing right before the show. I brought some headphones and listened to a 30-minute playlist while I put on my makeup each night. I couldn't worry about the other actors thinking I was antisocial. I had to walk out on stage and give a performance. For me, the time to chat was after the performance. Don't be afraid to be a little self-indulgent. It's okay to have rituals. It's okay to have needs. The important thing is that we find a way to create a mutually satisfying environment. A quick recap of the do's and don'ts on set. Do: read every script you receive and check for new changes. Be honest with wardrobe about your sizes. Be on time. Check in with a production assistant when you arrive. Bring your ID and social security card or passport. Bring specialty food items and snacks if needed. Know your lines. Be prepared to wait a lot. Definitely eat the free food. Help to create a safe environment for everyone. Ask questions if you don't understand something. Find out what you need to thrive. And now the don'ts. Don't take or post photos of the actors, the set, or yourself at work. Don't post information or spoilers about the job on social media. Don't ask for professional favors from the cast or director. Don't gossip. Don't allow another actor or director to take advantage of you. Don't stop a scene in the middle. Just keep going until you hear cut. Don't judge your fellow actors. And don't take things personally. Chapter 6. The Journey. Perseverance is not a long race. It is many short races, one after another. Walter Elliott. I had been living in Los Angeles for 2 years when, one day, I walked into a Pottery Barn and suddenly suffered an anxiety attack. I had gone to Pottery Barn to buy a friend something off her bridal registry and panicked when I couldn't afford a single item on her list. As I looked around the store, I wondered if I would ever be able to afford to shop in a place like this. My friend was 24, had a good job, and was getting married. Her list included all sorts of adult things like a handcrafted dinnerware set and 400 thread count sheets. My life was a complete mess. I was living with a stranger I'd found through a roommate matching company after my first roommate gave up acting and moved back home. My credit card had gone into default. My acting career was non-existent. I still wasn't in the union, and I hadn't heard from my agent in months. Oh, and I'd almost just accidentally become a high-priced call girl. My future looked like an endless tunnel of rejection and shitty apartments filled with thrift store crap. So, I lost it. Right there in Pottery Barn, sitting on one of their beautiful Chesterfield leather sofas that I couldn't afford, I lost my shit. What the hell am I doing? I thought. No one cares that I'm here. Between sobs, I heard cheerful Christmas music playing in the store. Oh my God, I couldn't take another extended family Christmas party with questions like, when am I going to see you on TV? And how's Holly Weird treating you? I seriously wanted to quit. I often tell this story when I speak to acting students, because of all the questions I get, aspiring actors mostly want to know how to endure the rejection, confusion, doubts, and seemingly insurmountable hurdles of an acting career. I wish there was an easy answer. All I can say is, I've been there. Every artist has a different journey, and you'll have to figure out yours. You'll have to determine how much you can endure, because the roadblocks, doubts, and insecurity are all part of living an artistic life. Back there in Pottery Barn, to keep going, I had to adjust my expectations about what it meant to be an actor. First, I needed to accept that things weren't going to happen quickly. A lot of my anxiety was coming from my belief that I was failing because things were taking so long. I needed to stop comparing myself to other people and commit to an actor's life with all its ups and downs. Then, I needed to change my approach. Being an actor is a lifestyle. I wasn't able to shop at Pottery Barn because I hadn't chosen the well-worn path of a conventional job. I had chosen the path of an artist. I needed to embrace my decision. If I could go back and give sobbing Jenna some advice to make it easier, here's what I would say. Step 1. Give yourself permission to be an actor. Don't apologize for being weird. Live an unashamed artistic life. Step 2. Create your own work. Step 3. Never give up. Ultimately, you have to find your own way. And you will. So be patient with yourself. Try to embrace the journey. And maybe try to stay out of Pottery Barn until you book your first big job. My path. Most of my struggling years were spent trying to stay busy enough that I wouldn't notice that the phone wasn't ringing. I did things like create a detailed card catalog of all the casting directors for whom I'd auditioned. I wrote down what I wore, how I felt I did, and if I got a call back. This card catalog served no practical purpose. It was 100% something I did to keep from going mad. I stopped updating it years ago, but I still have it sitting on my shelf in my office. When I worked short temp jobs as a receptionist, I would sometimes speak in different accents. Yes, that's a little weird, especially when you consider that I'm horrible at accents. But I didn't care. Sometimes I'd go people watching or sit at a diner and eavesdrop on conversations. I liked studying the way people behaved in different situations. I especially liked listening to people fight. I guess that's the ambulance chaser in me. Guess what? When people get really, really mad, they often get quieter, not louder. Cool thing to try in my next fight scene. In between my various auditions for The Office, which happened over the course of a few months, I did everyday tasks while pretending to be Pam. I grocery shopped, did laundry, and went to the movies as Pam. Pam is a person who has a hard time standing up for herself. So, for example, when someone cut in front of me at the grocery store, I said nothing. As Jenna, I would have spoken up, but as Pam, I just stewed silently. I created so many details about Pam's life that it became easy to improvise at my auditions. I still do this exercise sometimes when preparing for a new role. Another project I did to keep myself occupied was to develop and perform a silent comedic magic show. Yeah, you heard that right. Silent comedic magic. Here's how it all began. I was at a party, and my friend Brian started doing funny fake magic tricks using his hands and fingers. It was something he'd been doing for years as a party gag. It was hilarious. After I begged him, he gave me permission to develop it into an act. I went home and worked on it, eventually perfecting 5 tricks. Then I made a series of homemade props, bought a secondhand tuxedo, slicked my hair back, and got myself booked in comedy clubs. I so wish I had a photo of myself doing this. At the small comedy clubs, to get on the docket, you had to bring your own audience. The more people you brought, the better your time slot. So, I did my act a handful of times, inviting everyone I knew. It was always fun, and people always laughed. I loved performing it. Until one night, at a place in the valley, I didn't have a single person show up. 0 guests. The booker took pity on me and said I could do my act anyway. He put me up second to last. When my turn came, as I walked to the stage in my vintage tuxedo carrying my various accessories, I heard someone mumble under their breath, "Oh great, prop comedy." It felt like a punch in the gut. I did my best to ignore him and went on stage anyway. I performed my first trick and no one laughed. Nothing. Ugh. This was a tough room and I had 4 more tricks to go. For the second trick, I held up a sign asking for a volunteer from the audience. No one raised their hand. I just stood there, in silence, holding a piece of poster board. Crickets. Oh my God. My 5-minute act suddenly felt 3 hours long. I was so humiliated. I skipped that trick and quickly got through the final three, then slumped off the stage to sympathy applause. That was the last time I ever did my comedy magic act. Talk about going out with a whimper. But seriously, I loved that act. I love that I did it. It didn't get me discovered by any agents or casting directors, nor did it get me auditions or offers from producers. But it did get me out of the house. It gave me a place to focus all of my unused creative energy. I was going to comedy clubs, watching other people perform, and surrounding myself with creative people. That act kept me going for about 7 months. It fed my soul. Until that night in the valley when it crushed it. After the magic act was shelved, I needed a new outlet. I started drawing. Even though I had never drawn anything in my life, I decided to try drawing my own autobiographical comic book. I enrolled in a drawing class at my local learning center and bought a dozen books on how to draw comics. I started by drawing one panel a day. A friend saw my drawings and asked me to collaborate with her on a book to help people with eye strain. So I illustrated a book on eye strain, never published, which then led to my illustrating a coloring book for a man who ran a center for children with hearing disabilities. It felt so good to produce something. It felt good to have no one but myself to please. My drawing was a safe way to escape the pains of rejection and longing during my years of waiting for a break. My friend Nick Offerman and I were recently talking about the idea of having a separate outlet for our creativity, as he is a master woodworker. He told me this. I would credit my woodworking as an entirely separate creative outlet, refreshingly unconnected to the showbiz. I used to love nothing more than driving away from some sweaty test audition for a pilot, heading to my shop and making something, anything, out of wood. The satisfaction of tangibly creating something tactile that I could hold and see and enjoy, on which no network or studio could give me notes, was priceless. Doing my silent comedy act and learning to draw were nice distractions, but I found the most fulfilling activity was when I volunteered for an animal charity as a foster parent. It was my job to house, care for, and rehabilitate sick and injured cats or kittens and then find them a forever home. If you're looking to quickly escape from your self-obsessed, self-involved actor brain, try nursing a litter of sickly 5-week-old kittens back to health. Nothing made me forget about losing a job faster than trying to wrangle eye drops into the goopy faces of flea-ridden cats fresh from the pound, or waking up every few hours to feed them around the clock. Over the course of 3 years, I fostered and found homes for 14 cats. I can't tell you how much I needed this kind of selfless volunteer work. Having an obligation to something bigger than my own ambition made my life feel more meaningful. And, oh my God, the kittens were so cute. During this time, I remember being at a particularly horrible audition with a particularly nasty casting director. It was a situation that, in the past, would have left me in a puddle of my own tears for days. But instead, after she condescended to me, I thought, screw you, lady. Yesterday I drove 2 hours and fished a box of abandoned kittens out of a filthy dumpster. You can take your shitty 2-line role and shove it. Having that box of kittens put things in perspective. My entire self-worth wasn't riding on an audition. Ironically, as a result, I started doing better. My auditions were better because I didn't need it all so much. And you can't fake that. You can't fake not needing it. Ever notice how you do so much better at the auditions you don't really care about? When I started doing the rescue work, I felt a calling that was separate from acting. It made all of my auditions less important to me, and that seemed to make people more interested. Funny how that works. I didn't come to these life-changing ideas all by myself. I was lucky enough to find a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. The Artist's Way is a 12-week, self-led creativity seminar in the form of a book. Almost every aspiring actor I know eventually finds The Artist's Way. But while many people start the book, few actually finished. It took me 2 tries. It's challenging. Each week, you read a new chapter and confront the obstacles that are blocking you from moving forward as an artist. The greatest thing about the book is that it's active. It's a workbook, You aren't just reading about how to be creative. You are actually being creative, writing and performing and finding new ways to express yourself. In my case, it was the artist's way that got me to create my magic show and start drawing. And by the end of 12 weeks, I had written a treatment for a movie that I later filmed with my friends. If you ever find yourself uncontrollably sobbing in a Pottery Barn or Crate and Barrel, go by the artist's way. Take risks. I soldiered on, and after 3 more years in Los Angeles, finally found myself with an agent and a manager. I was in SAG. I was getting auditions. I was a member of a terrific theater company and had learned great audition techniques. But more importantly, I was getting callbacks and had even booked a few small roles. Things were starting to feel legit. A few years after the Pottery Barn fiasco, I finally felt like I'd figured out what it meant to be an actor. But I was still earning the bulk of my money from my day job as a receptionist. And while I was booking small acting jobs here and there, I couldn't seem to break out of the bit player club. My characters rarely had a name. I played college girl number one, or waitress. The point of my roles was usually to relay plot information, such as, "Yes, I saw the suspect around midnight. She was covered in blood." Or to set up the main actor for a big comedic moment like, "I have a delivery for Mr. Thompson, one blow-up doll." I was working my ass off to get 5 minutes on your TV a few times a year. I had figured out the essentials of the business, but now I had a new dilemma. I was stuck. I didn't want jobs. I wanted a career. I wanted to earn my living as an actor. No more day job. No more catering on the side. I wanted to play characters with real names and juicy plots. How did people do that? I reminded myself that I was the CEO of my acting business. If it wasn't moving in the direction I wanted, it was my responsibility to make it happen. Rather than sit around complaining, I needed to take action. I decided to look at my company with a more critical eye and ask, where can I make improvements? I landed on my agent, Charlie. I loved Charlie on a personal level. I trusted him. He'd been a great champion of mine, which is worth a lot. On the other hand, Charlie was at a smaller agency with only 3 agents. And while Charlie and I had a great relationship, the head of the agency never took a shine to me. Around this time, the 3rd agent, a woman I really liked, left to start a management business of her own. So now I was at an agency with only 2 agents, and one of them didn't even like me. While Charlie could get me auditions for smaller one-day roles on television shows, he was having a harder time getting me in the door for the bigger stuff. And the fact that the head of the agency was unenthusiastic about me meant that she wouldn't be putting her muscle and resources behind me. My manager, Naomi, was getting me meetings with people like Judd Apatow and huge casting directors like Bonnie Zane and Allison Jones, and those meetings were leading to big things like testing for my first pilot. I wanted my whole team to be as effective as Naomi. If I looked at the situation strategically, rather than emotionally, it was clear that it was time for me to find a new agent. Naomi was very excited when I told her I was ready to make a change. She had wanted me to move on for a while, but anytime she even tried to discuss changing agents, I'd dig in and refuse to budge. Part of my stubbornness was out of loyalty, but if I'm being honest, the bigger part was out of fear. What if I couldn't book the bigger roles? At least now I could blame my agent. But if I had access to more prestigious auditions, I'd only have myself to blame if my career didn't take off. Basically, it was easier to complain about the career I didn't have than to take action and make it happen. I have known a lot of actors who've stayed with the wrong agent because they believed it's better to have any agent than no agent at all, or because they're afraid to take risks, do the work, be rejected, or have hurt feelings. But staying in a situation that doesn't serve you is a career killer. Over the years, Charlie would joke with me, "Jenna, one day you're going to leave me for the big time." And I would always say, "I hope so, Charlie. I hope so." And we would chuckle. But when the time came to tell him that I was ready to move on, I was anything but laughing. Charlie was kind. He said he was disappointed, but also that he understood. He told me that he loves the challenge of building a new career, and he knows that if he does his job well, people will outgrow him. There was hugging, tears, and well-wishing. Naomi and I spoke about what new agent might be best for me. Her top pick was an agent we'll call Tom. Tom was the head of a medium-sized agency, tenacious and well-respected for having a good eye for talent. Naomi had another actress client with Tom who was constantly going out for lead roles in pilots and big guest star roles, and her resume was not much bigger than mine. Thanks to Naomi's connection, Tom looked at my reel and agreed to meet with me. Luckily, we clicked. Our first pilot season together, I had more auditions than I could have ever imagined. I also started booking lead guest roles. It was during our time together that I booked my big guest role on That 70s Show, a recurring role on 6 Feet Under, and the pilot for Rubbing Charlie. We were a good team. 2 years later, I was earning as much money from my acting work as I had as a full-time administrative assistant. After 7 years in Los Angeles, I was finally able to quit my day job. Clearly, changing agents was a risk that paid off. But as fruitful as our relationship was, Tom wasn't my last agent. After The Office became a big hit, I moved on to William Morris Endeavor, where I am today. At the bigger agencies, you get a team of specialists. They assign you a different agent for every area of the business. It's something the medium-sized agencies just can't do. So now, I have a bunch of agents. 2 for film, 1 for television, 1 for theater, 2 for publishing, 1 for voiceover work, and 1 for advertising and commercials. They have the ability to package films and television shows or to even help me develop my own projects. Here's the bottom line. You are in charge of your momentum. If you are feeling stalled or experiencing a drought, you must try anything and everything to reset the course of your career. Ask yourself if there's a risk you aren't taking. Is there a move you should make? Maybe it's not a professional move, but a personal one, like ditching a roommate that weighs you down, or getting out of a day job that has completely derailed your focus. Maybe go out of town, go camping, sign up for a yoga retreat. How long since you took an acting class? I have a friend who got a job at a coffee shop as a barista because the owner promised him flexible hours and plenty of time to pursue his acting career. 2 years later, he was the manager. He was so busy with the coffee shop that he had to put his acting career on hold. When I asked him why he didn't quit, he said he felt bad because the owner was going through an ugly divorce and needed him to keep the shop going while she figured things out. It was the type of thing that could go on forever. I asked him, "Did you really move all the way to Los Angeles to run a coffee shop? You could have done that at home." It was the wake-up call he needed. He gave his notice and now works very happily as an actor and theater producer. Create your own work. I know I've said it before, but it's worth repeating here. The single best thing an actor can do, both professionally and personally, is to create their own work. This could be as simple as memorizing a Shakespearean monologue and performing it in Washington Square Park. Or maybe start a podcast with a friend. Or write a play. Or start your own YouTube channel. Whatever you do, I promise it will create momentum. Take, for example, the time then-struggling actor Rob McElhaney approached his actor friends Charlie Day and Glenn Howerton about an idea for a TV show. Rob recently explained his inspiration. It was just an idea of a guy going over to another guy's house to ask him for sugar, and the other guy telling him that he has cancer. And instead of the friend being compassionate, he just wants to get the sugar and get out the door. I knew that nobody else would think that was funny except Glenn and Charlie, so I wrote a script and showed it to them. Using their own camera, they shot a pilot episode for less than $200. They showed the pilot to various studios, and it was picked up by FX for a full season. The show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, was just renewed for both a 12th and 13th season in 2016. One of my favorite examples of the benefits that can come from creating your own work is my friend Mark Brooks, who had a recurring role as Dwight's handyman for 2 seasons on The Office. If you aren't familiar with Mark, go to YouTube and search K-Strass Yo-Yo Guy. You won't be sorry. K-Strass is a character that Mark created, a self-proclaimed yo-yo master who's actually terrible at the yo-yo. In a series of hilarious pranks, Mark got Kay Strass booked as a guest on various local news programs in the Midwest. The result is absurdly hilarious. When the writers of The Office discovered his videos, they offered him a recurring role in the show. Here's Mark's amazing story in his own words.
I was living in Milwaukee, 2010, working at a small content marketing firm. I had been in and out of grad school, taking temp jobs when needed, basically doing my best at avoiding any sort of career. I had been working on short films with a group of friends and took those around the festival circuit, but nothing really came of it. I was always acting in the films and doing silly characters that I found funny. Then my friend, Joe Pickett, and I came up with the idea of booking one of my characters, Kenny K. Strasser, a self-destructing, self-proclaimed yo-yo master, onto local morning news shows. The morning of my first appearance, I woke up at 4 a.m. I needed to drive 2 hours from Milwaukee to Green Bay. It was winter, and I remember lying in bed thinking the last thing I wanted to do was get out of my warm bed and drive to Green Bay in the middle of a blizzard. But then I thought, what the hell else am I doing? After the first couple morning show appearances, people started uploading them to YouTube. I was bummed at first because I figured it would blow my cover and I wouldn't be able to do any more appearances. This turned out to be true. What I didn't even fathom was that people out in Los Angeles were becoming fans. Not in my wildest imagination did I think goofing around on morning shows to make my friends laugh would lead to a career in Hollywood. But I think that's why it works so well. I was just doing something I love to do without the worry of expectations.
Mark has been working in Los Angeles as an actor and writer ever since. Oh, he also ended up marrying Amelie Gillette, the writer from The Office who first discovered him. He got a wife and a career out of making his own work. That's an amazing story, right? I also experienced a major breakthrough as a result of creating my own work. Inspired by Rob Reiner's masterpiece, This is Spinal Tap, I had an idea for a mockumentary based on a group of misguided charity workers. Not being a writer, I didn't have a script, so I invited some actor friends over one Saturday afternoon. I set up a camera, explained my idea, and asked everyone to improvise. Over the next few hours, we pretended we were holding our first meeting for a very special charity. We had a blast. We did this exercise a few more times, and eventually, I transcribed the tapes and wrote a script. It was far from perfect. Still, I thought, let's shoot this thing for real. It will still be improvised, but now we have an outline that we can use as a blueprint. I set out to make our movie look as real as possible. I thought, what if we could trick people into thinking this was a real documentary about these dreadful people? So we purposely made the camera work messy, and the actors were allowed to regard the camera if they wanted. We even filmed talking head interviews with each character. Over the course of a year, we shot our little movie on the weekends or whenever everyone was available. When it was finished, we got into a few short film festivals. It seemed like the whole thing was going to be another silent comedic magic show. Fun times, but ultimately leading nowhere. But shortly after I finished the project, I was called in to audition for the American version of The Office. I couldn't believe my luck. I'd just spent the last year of my life practicing the mock documentary style of acting, and here I was being asked to audition for a television show that was conceived in the same style. I have no doubt this experience played in my favor as I auditioned. Another important milestone that came from my self-made movie, it was the first project I'd actually finished. Over the years, I'd started many creative projects, but failed to finish a single one of them. Once I finished my movie, I knew I could finish anything. And I have. Here's the trick I used to help me get through. Whatever you decide to make, tell yourself it's going to suck. Want to write a script? Good. It's going to be awful. Want to film a web series with your friends? Fantastic. It's going to be dreadful. Whatever you do, know that it's going to be a disgusting mess of awfulness. And then, do it anyway. Something awful is better than something incomplete. Because the only way to improve is to finish something. Look at it. Learn from it. And then start something new. The new thing will be better. And then the thing after that, and the thing after that. But you can't get better if you don't finish anything. My movie isn't great, It is clunky and choppy and has bad sound. But it's also funny and daring and weird, and I love it. And now I'm a finisher. I finish things. Every project you finish has value. Whether it's the one-woman show you wrote, the web series with only 24 views, the pilot you wrote with your friend, all are important and will pay off somehow. Putting things in the vault is important. I have a friend who has been writing a hilarious and irreverent series of children's books for the past 2 years. She's a struggling actress who said to me one day, "I don't know why I keep doing these books. No one is going to publish them. At the very least, they keep me sane and I love them." And I said to her, "One day, you're going to break out in a big way. I just know it. And your fancy new agent is going to ask you what ideas you have. You will go into your vault, pull out this series of children's books, and say that you have a fully developed idea for an animated series. And it will happen." Because that's how this stuff works. When you become a busy working actor, you won't have time to fill the vault. So fill it now. A successful writer I've known for years has a stack of at least a dozen scripts she wrote during her years as a struggling writer. They are all great. Now that she's a success, she can dust them off, give them a polish, and get them produced. To the outsider, it looks as if she's writing 3 genius scripts a year. Nope. She has her vault. I just got fired. Oh my God. This is very humbling. I just got fired. Ouch. Let me take a moment to collect my thoughts. Wow. This sucks. And it's also a bit embarrassing. I mean, here I am writing the chapter of my book that's all about the struggle and how it never really ends, and an artist's life has many ups and downs, and you have to learn to stay positive and embrace the journey, blah, blah, blah. I just got fired. Let me back up. After a lovely break from acting, where I had a second child and stayed home to be a mama, I decided it was time to go back to work. So I did a pilot for CBS starring Matt LeBlanc about a dad who has to take on more parenting responsibilities when his wife, me, goes back to work. It was a multi-camera sitcom filmed at a studio 15 minutes from my house with family-friendly hours that allowed me to drop my son off at school every morning and be home for dinner each night. Not only that, but it was directed by legendary sitcom director James Burrows. He's directed Friends, Will and Grace, Mike and Molly, basically every great 3-camera comedy you've ever seen. And it was created by a writing team from That 70s Show, Jeff and Jackie Filgo. Great cast, great paycheck, family friendly. I'm the luckiest gal in the world, I thought. I enter back into the workforce and land a great gig right out of the gate. So, we shot the pilot, and it felt great. Everyone loved everyone. The audience laughed, the network seemed happy. Hugs and kisses all around. We were clearly destined for a pickup. "See you soon," we all said as we left the stages on our last day of work. No one said words like "hopefully" or "fingers crossed." I mean, come on. CBS, Matt LeBlanc, Jenna Fisher, James Burrows, Jeff and Jackie Filgo. We were getting picked up for sure. 1 month later, the day all the pilots were getting news of their pickups, my phone rings. On the line are all of my agents, my manager, and my publicist. I thought, they must be calling to congratulate me on my new television series. "It's bad news," they started out. "What? We didn't get picked up? That's crazy. That makes no sense. Everyone said it was a sure thing." Silence on the line. "No, it's worse than that, Jenna." "What do you mean?" "Oh, no. Did I get fired?" "Yeah. Focus groups didn't like the chemistry between you and Matt. They just didn't believe you as a couple. So the network is moving ahead with the show but letting you go, since it's Matt's show. We're really sorry." Ooh. Kick in the stomach. I went from having the perfect job to having no job. I immediately went to a dark place. I figured it must be me. It must be that I sucked, that I was horrible. I told my agents I wanted to see the pilot. I wanted to see my performance in case there was anything I could learn from the experience for next time. Thankfully, CBS agreed to send me a link. My husband and I watched it, and You know what? We loved my performance. I was upbeat and funny and charming. I thought I did a great job. But I have to admit that Matt and I, despite getting along very well off camera, seemed mismatched as husband and wife. Somehow it didn't make sense. Chemistry is a tricky thing. It probably didn't help that we were both so well known for other roles. I learned later that a common comment in the focus groups was, "I just don't believe Pam would marry Joey." Ugh. Dealing with it. Even though I'm happy with my performance, it's not making the rejection any easier. So, how am I dealing with it? Eating a corn dog. And Oreos. And ice cream. Potato chips, guacamole. While writing this paragraph, I ate a half a bag of Doritos. As it turns out, not only is food the best part of getting an acting job, it's also the best part of being fired. By the way, early in our discussion of this book, my publisher suggested I write advice about what to do if you get fired, as it's a pretty common thing in this business. I told him it was a great idea, but I couldn't give that advice because I'd never been fired. Well, now I've been fired. I hope you're happy, Glenn. To everyone on the outside, I seem to be taking the news very well. But on the inside, I feel heavy and hopeless. I'm doing weird things like waking up extra early to do my hair and makeup and wear high heels to drop my son off at school in the morning. Look at me, everyone. I'm not totally freaking out and feeling worthless. You can tell by my beautiful hair and shoes. Then I'll come home and crawl in bed. Except I can't really crawl into bed because I have this book to write, floors to sweep, and my daughter's birthday party to plan. I've toyed with the idea of getting bangs. I sent a photo with mock bangs to all of my friends, and they all told me not to do it. I've started Googling stories of other actors who have been fired. It turns out Glenn was right. This really does happen a lot, and everyone seems to survive. In fact, I discovered that three other actors have been fired from James Burrow's shows, and all of them have gone on to do great things. They are Lisa Kudrow, fired from Frasier, Ray Romano, fired from News Radio, and Bob Odenkirk, fired from Will and Grace. I'm thinking of getting the four of us together for a show called Canned by Burrows. I think it could be a hit, but I'll probably get recast. I found an amazing transcript of a 2010 commencement speech that Lisa Kudrow gave about her experience of being fired. It lifted me up. I also started reaching out to my actor friends, telling them I had been fired. It turns out almost all of them had been fired at some point in their careers, too. I told them my story, they told me theirs. It felt so good to know I wasn't alone. I started feeling like I might be okay. This is why that family of artists I told you to find in Chapter 1 is so very important. They are the only people who will really understand at a time like this. Your parents will try to understand. Your best friend from college, who works for a nonprofit, will kind of understand. But your artist friends will completely get it. And they will know exactly what to say when you reach out for help. Take, for example, this amazing email I got from my friend Sean Gunn when I wrote and asked him the question, "Any thoughts on being fired and how to deal with the deep pit of self-doubt and despair it brings?" He said, "Yes. I had a conversation many years ago about getting fired with some friends, saying we knew it would happen sooner or later. We made a pact that when we did, we would go out and celebrate. Since then, we've done just that, and it's quite liberating. So crack open a nice bottle you've been saving for a special occasion, or maybe get a sitter and go out on the town, and enjoy. You deserve it." So, on the day CBS was set to publicly announce the news of my firing, I took Sean's advice and celebrated. We hired a sitter, my husband took me to Palm Springs, I got drunk, and I went swimming. I created a photo essay that you can see, along with some other great photos, in the downloadable PDF that comes with this audiobook. And that pretty much brings us to today. I've been in Los Angeles for 20 years, and I'm still looking at the phone, wondering if any exciting jobs will come my way. Such is the actor's life. At one point, I considered calling this book The Actor's Life, Struggle, Work, Repeat. But perhaps a more accurate title would be The Actor's Life, Struggle, 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 Cry, Think You Should Give Up, Work, Repeat. You see, here's the truth I've learned after 20 years in the business. No job really changes everything. Nothing removes the struggle completely. When I look back over my career, there are so many moments that I thought would change everything. Pilots I tested for that didn't happen. Pilots I got that were never picked up. A recurring role